Good morning. You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. And as you know, this is the radio show that's dedicated to women who are ready to love life and to make joy a part of the daily dialogue. So here we are, ladies. It's another Saturday morning. It's early, it's cold, and I invite you to join me this morning. I'm having my cup of mint tea. I'm reaching over to grab it. And I invite you to go get your favorite, maybe warm beverage, and find a nice warm place to let the next 60 minutes be all about you. Because I know what we do as women is we give a lot of ourselves every week. And I just really so much appreciate this time that we have together to kind of recollect ourselves and remember who we are and maybe even the places within ourselves we want to cultivate. So I'm really excited about the show this morning. I'm going to read a passage from a book that I just started reading a few days ago. Meditation allows us to stop looking for happiness in all the wrong places. Real abiding happiness, we discover, isn't the result of getting our needs met temporarily. That often leads to an endless cycle of disappointment and escalating desire. Can you relate to this? The things we pin our hopes on don't prove to be enough. The bar is continually being raised, and then we're on the lookout for something more. One of America's leading spiritual teachers and authors, Sharon Salzberg, is the co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society in
Barre,
Massachusetts. She has played a crucial role in bringing Asian meditation practices to the West. The ancient Buddhist practices of vipassana, or mindfulness, and metta, loving kindness, are the foundations of her work. She's done a lot of really interesting work. Internally, I know, but certainly externally, Sharon is a regular contributor to the Huffington Post, and she's been a contributing editor of Oprah's O magazine for several years. She's appeared in numerous magazines, including Time Magazine, Yoga Journal, MSNBC.com, Self, Tricycle, Real Simple, Good Housekeeping, and on and on. Good morning, Sharon.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
I'm just so thrilled and delighted. And since this is right up your alley, will you lead us in a practice this morning?
Sure. How long would you like that?
A couple of minutes.
Okay.
2 or 3 minutes.
Okay. Well, often the fundamental practice that's done in many, many traditions is just sitting down and feeling your breath, feeling the actual sensations of your breath. And as presented to me, as one of my early teachers said to me, the breath is so often chosen as this kind of gathering point for our attention for a few different reasons. One is that you don't have to believe anything in order to feel your breath. You don't have to call yourself a Buddhist or Hindu or reject anything else. And then, as he went on to say, I've always felt quite charmingly, he said the breath is very portable. If we can practice in this more, you could say, determined or formal time, like, okay, now I'm going to sit down and meditate, we can also practice anywhere we're breathing, waiting in line, being anxious in a doctor's waiting room, being in traffic, all kinds of situations. So we come to really just feel the normal, natural breath. This is an exercise in breathing. It's an exercise in awareness. So I'd say if you could sit comfortably, chair is fine, couch is fine. Close your eyes or not, however you feel most at ease. See if you can find that place where the breath is most distinct for you. Maybe it's the movement of air at the nostrils. Maybe it's the rising, falling movement of your chest or your abdomen. Just the normal, natural breath. You find that place, bring your attention there, and just rest. As images or sounds or sensations or emotions arise, if they're not all that strong, if you can stay connected to the feeling of the breath, just let them flow on by. You're breathing. But if something comes up and sweeps you away, you get lost in thought, you even fall asleep, it's not a problem. We consider the moment that you realize you've been distracted to be really the magic moment in the meditation practice, because that's the moment where instead of judging yourself or criticizing yourself, you can gently let go and simply begin again. Just bring your attention back to the feeling of the breath. And if you have to let go over and over again and begin again, that's perfectly fine. And when you feel ready, you can open your eyes.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was nice.
It allowed me to re-find myself right here. You know, I was feeling my heart beating, and it's because I'm so excited to be talking with you this morning. So thank you.
Thank you.
We all want happiness. And I feel like there's so many people I talk to who would say that they're not happy. Why is it so elusive, Sharon? I mean, you would think it would be kind of easy.
You would think that.
I would.
I think there are a few reasons. One is, I don't think it's actually that easy to claim the wish to be happy. So many times people say that's too selfish, that's too self-centered, that's like greed or grasping, and yet that urge toward happiness, which we are said to all share, every single one of us, is quite a beautiful thing. It's nothing to feel squeamish about or frightened of, because when that urge is combined with wisdom instead of with ignorance about where more genuine happiness is to be found, then it becomes like our homing instinct for freedom, and we can cut through lots and lots of obstacles. So the first issue really is knowing it's okay to want to be happy. And then the second is that question of ignorance. We get so many messages about where happiness is to be found, like do this, buy that, get
right.
that, do that. That it takes a lot, I think, just to step back. And as you said, it's almost like looking within. It's internalizing the question instead of looking outside of ourselves all the time and say, what do I really need in order to be happy right now?
You know, and as you were sharing that breath practice with us, Sharon, I was thinking about that idea of that magic moment. Because at that magic moment, we can either say to ourselves, you idiot, you've done it again. Look, you know, you've screwed up. You're not a good meditator. See, I knew you couldn't do this. Or we can welcome ourselves back. And, you know, I have this image of kind of like getting down like you would with a small child and opening up my arms and saying, welcome back. And I think that is a magic moment.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pivotal moment that we get to make this choice, because the first conversation is probably going to not lead to happiness. The second conversation might have a better chance of it.
Yeah. No, definitely. And that's a perfect example, because certainly we have the more common habit of chastising ourselves and berating ourselves and judging ourselves and criticizing ourselves. You idiot. Why are you thinking again? Why'd you get distracted? Why did that happen? You're so bad. You can't do it. And it's also a process that's a little bit different. It's not a process of accumulation. Like I used to think success in meditation would be, okay, today I could only be with 3 breaths in a row before my mind wandered. Tomorrow it'll be 8. Then it'll be 18. By next week it'll be 45. And it's not that. It's actually that letting go process and the ability to begin again so heartfully and so kindly toward ourselves. That's the transformation. So even if it's never more than 2, doesn't matter. And that's actually kind of unbelievable for us.
How long did it take you to be able to find that place of loving kindness to yourself from when you first started meditating? Because I can only guess, my experience is that you don't, I didn't start out that way.
Yeah, I didn't start out that way either. Well, of course, it's always a process, and certainly it's still ongoing. But that particular kind of understanding, say with the breath, it came after some months because I came into the practice with a tremendous amount of self-judgment and determination to do it right. And it felt like I just was never doing it right. I wasn't doing it. And because my mind would always wander. And yet my teachers were saying over and over and over and over again, that's okay. That's natural. That's the way the mind has been trained. One teacher said, it's like you're exercising the letting go muscle. That's good. Don't worry about how many times your attention wanders. Just let go. And you're deepening the qualities of loving kindness and compassion when you can begin again. Look at that amazing thing. You can begin again. Nothing is ruined. Nothing's lost. You can renew. You can start over. And then I began to realize that that was an example of the kind of little exercise that seems so simple that really meant a life-changing practice, because we don't work at that just to be a good meditator, because we practice in the end not to be a good meditator, but to have a different kind of life. And that's the kind of life lesson that we're actually learning. If we can do it here in a meditation session, we also get better at doing it when we've made a mistake, when we've blown it, when we've lost sight of our aspiration, when we've strayed from our chosen course. We've cultivated a much greater ability to begin again.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till. And this morning, I am delighted to tell you that my guest is Sharon Salzberg, and she is the author of Real Happiness, The Power of Meditation, a 28-day program. Sharon, why? I've been reading your book, and I've been reading about these benefits of meditation. I know that there's been a lot of research over the last decade, as opposed to before there was hardly any research for the last century. And why should we meditate? Why should we even consider doing it?
Well, I think of meditation actually as a kind of skills training. It's, first of all, a skills training in concentration. Most of us feel ourselves to be somewhat scattered or distracted or untogether, uncentered. And the process of deepening meditation means deepening concentration so that we can take all of that kind of scattered, distracted energy and bring it together, to gather it together. So we're empowered by that, because that's a lot of energy that could be available to us and just isn't, because it's flying all over the place. And there's also said to be a kind of healing in that, because the larger manifestation of that lack of concentration is often a kind of fragmentation. It's the way people say, I feel like I'm one person at work and a different person at home. We just don't feel integrated or together. Or my favorite comment probably along those lines was when I was teaching somewhere and somebody raised her hand and she said, I feel filled with loving kindness and compassion for all beings everywhere as long as I'm alone. But once I'm with others, it's really rough. Or we can be the other way around. We can feel fine when we're with others and very ill at ease being alone. So we're just kind of bringing ourselves together in that process of concentration. And then it's a training in mindfulness, which is a word that's getting so popular, mm-hmm. in part because of all the research, which really means an ability to be aware of our experience without adding on to it. Distortions from the past, future projection. You know, what's it going to feel like in 10 minutes? What's it going to feel like in 20 minutes? So that we can actually be much more in touch with our experience as it actually is. And it's been mindfulness as a quality of mind that has been investigated more and more in terms of effects on one's immune system and actual changes in brain structure and all kinds of things like that. And then I also actually consider meditation a training in loving kindness or compassion. It's like, even if you think about that moment in the practice we just did, when you realized, woo, it's been quite some time since I last felt a breath, what do we need to be able to let go and begin again? We need a greater and greater depth of compassion.
I'm going to read a quote out of your book. You say, I often ask my students, if you learn that there's a simple, safe activity you could do for 20 minutes a day to help a friend in need, would you do it? The answer, of course, would, they would, eagerly and without question.
There you go.
Why is it so darn hard? That's what I want to know.
That's part of it. I was thinking of that story, that illustration before.
Yeah.
I think it is hard. I think it's hard, first of all, to realize and appreciate that our own happiness is of benefit to others, not just because we're not in such a bad mood all the time, but it's like inner resourcefulness, resiliency. Some people in very, very tough situations don't honor the fact that their own happiness would allow them to hang in there in a better way. They think it's too diverting, it's too distracting to think of themselves and what might elevate their own situation, their own, you know, mood or feeling or sense of self-respect or whatever it might be. But actually, what is the truth? What's a realistic picture of our experience? It is our own happiness when it's not the kind of happiness that's just endlessly seeking pleasure, but when it's the kind of happiness that has to do with that kind of integration of our being and sense of wholeness and very profound connection, then it is what keeps us going as life brings us, you know, wonderful times and terrible times.
And boy, I feel like part of the what makes it hard, in air quotes, is that our culture is so designed and structured for me to be distracted and looking outside of myself. And I was just thinking about this recently, this way of I have created a sense of independence for myself by in large part or in some part due to the things that I've purchased and kind of installed in my life. And we, you know, we have the, you have to get the now, you have to get the newest iPhone, not the 3G, but the, not the 3GS, but the 4G. And the, you know, it's just this constant, it's not possible to get there. And what I have found in meditation is there's no place to get to. Mm-hmm. You know, we're right here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a 4G.
I will tell you. I've got a 3G.
But the reason I have it is because...
You probably need it.
No, my other one was dying. It was like freezing up all the time. And I needed one. It was actually quite hard to get because I was in New York City and they don't have them in... They didn't. I don't know about now. They didn't have them in stock. So you have to call every Apple store in the morning and say, did you get a shipment? And if they say yes, you got to run there and get online and... Oh,
now, is there a meditation app on the iPhone?
There are several, actually.
Really?
I even have one, I think.
I'm going to check it out.
But having a 4G, as with, I would probably say, all of my technology, I know how to use probably 1% of it. So am I going to devote my time to learning the other 99%?
Right.
That would probably be good at some point. But every day? Mm-hmm. Or am I going to do other things?
Yeah. Like meditate.
Like meditate.
How often do you meditate?
I sit every day.
Every day. For how long?
Usually around 45 minutes.
45 minutes. And I know I was just looking at your website today, and I saw that you are all over the place. So here, and then I think back to Washington, D.C., and then if I'm remembering correctly, then you go to New York, then you go to Philadelphia, you go back to New York. How do you...
Yep.
I'm out of breath just saying it. But how do you keep yourself together with all of that?
Well, it's not usually like that.
Okay.
Really, it's not usually that much. It's, you know, because the book just came out and it's brand new and I'm traveling a lot in support of it. And but travel is difficult. It's just difficult. And I was just not too long ago, I was on Maui because Ramdas is there. He's living there, and I both wanted to see him, and he's been doing retreats about once a year with a group of people, and so I could participate as, you know, a co-teacher in the retreat. So I went there, and of course, Ramdas's language, the way he expresses his spiritual perspective is very much in language like see the divine in yourself and see the divine in everybody. And so we had a wonderful time together. And then as I left, I got to the airport to find out that one of my flights home, I needed two flights, Maui to California, California to Boston, one of them had been canceled. And so it was really this terrible process of trying to get another flight. And the woman behind the ticket counter was very irritated and not that, I think, not that fond of me. And at one point I asked her a question, and she sort of yelled at me, and she said, "Stop asking me questions. You don't know anything. I've been doing this for 20 years. You know nothing." And then she said, "And it's weather. What do I look like, God?" And then I looked at her and I thought, funny you should say that. I just spent 5 days with Ramdas encouraging
that divine
practice. You know, I was like, wow. Okay, thank you for the reminder. So there are reminders along the way, even when things are kind of tough.
How did you respond to her? I mean, I'm assuming you didn't say that to her.
No. No, I said just sending her a lot of loving kindness and wishing her well.
Yeah.
She got me a flight. And I also realized there was only a certain amount I could do with her. And she got me a flight. And I went and sat down and called my travel agent with my 4G iPhone.
And got a better flight? Or
I got a better flight.
It must have been the 4G. You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till. We're going to take a short break here. And join me, come back, because Sharon Salzberg is going to be my guest for the second half of the show. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. And you know, this is the show dedicated to women who are ready to love life and make joy a part of the daily dialogue. And boy, what a great show to be listening to today to be moving in that direction. Sharon, my immediate response to your book was, I love how accessible it is to those of us who are first-time meditators, those of us who are totally intimidated by the idea of sitting still. I can't tell you how many people I've heard say, I couldn't sit still for 5 minutes. And it's just this process, you know, you break it down and make it so easy. Thank you.
Thank you. That was really very much my goal.
Yeah, it's really great. So I really recommend, if you have any inclination, and even if you don't have an inclination toward checking this out, I really encourage you to get Sharon's new book. It's the, of course, I love the title of it, Real Happiness, given that this show is real life. The Power of Meditation, a 28-day program. I've heard you say a number of times since we've been talking that meditation is not confined to this idea of religion or, you know, a certain belief system. But I'm curious I'm hoping this is okay to go here. I'm curious what you think of, what comes to your mind when somebody says the word God? Do you have anything?
You know, I really don't have so much, because I went to India when I was 18, and so my practice and my explorations have really been cradled within the Buddhist tradition.
Yeah.
From that time, and it's a long way from being 18, so it's been a lot of years. It's been 40 years.
So you don't carry with you that kind of image that many of us might have, which is kind of. And I don't mean to be disrespectful in any way, but an old man kind of out there or up there with long beard and hair and...
Well, a little bit. I mean, I was Jewish, So there is that. But somebody just asked me the other day what, from the Buddhist tradition, what might be the equivalent of transcendence. And I said it wouldn't be so much transcendence, but more a sense of like vast, vast, vast interconnection. So rather than going above or beyond the world, it's almost like going into the heart of it and seeing that really what we take to be solid and separate is actually almost part of a network. It's like the bigger fabric of life that we're all connected to. And I think that would be kind of somewhat similar.
When you say that we're all connected, you know, I've heard that before, and I've also heard the response that, does that mean, like, I'm the fisherman over in Italy, you know, out in the middle of some sea that I don't even know the name of? Am I part of him?
I wouldn't say necessarily that we're part of each other in that way, although many, many people, many traditions might, but more in the sense of, It's like if everybody right now just reflected for a few moments on how many people were involved in the fact that you're sitting or driving or however you're listening to this radio show right now. Perhaps, certainly if it was an intentional act, that was because someone told you about it, or they told you about their spiritual practice, or they told you about issues they'd faced, or they gave you a book, or they played you a piece of music, or they read you a poem, or your own spiritual life. And how many people have been involved in your own spiritual life? You know, very few people wake up in the morning and say, okay, now I'm there. You know, it's all a confluence of all these connections and relationships and influences and encounters and challenges. That's why we're here in this moment in time. So our lives are interconnected. They're not mushed together so that they're the same. But but how many forms of life were involved in the food that you've eaten today, even if it wasn't a distinct animal product? The creatures who live in the soil and who planted that seed and who harvested that crop and who provided it or prepared it for us. And that's how life actually is. The food doesn't just go poof, you know, here it is. So everything in our life is about this bigger confluence of connections.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. And this morning, Sharon Salzberg, who is the author of Real Happiness, The Power of Meditation, a 28-day program, is joining me. And, of course, you got to know, I'm loving this conversation. Sharon, so you grew up in New York,
mm-hmm.
and then at 18, you went to India.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine two cultures being more different. How did that difference help to frame your journey, if at all?
Well, I went to college in 16. I went to the State University of New York at Buffalo, and it was there that in my sophomore year, I took a course in Asian philosophy. Honestly, as far as I can remember, it was just happenstance. I thought, I need a Tuesday course. Let me take that one.
Boy, we are all so lucky for that happenstance.
Thank you. You know, and it turned out to be a course in Buddhism, which, of course, completely changed my life and in two different ways. One was the Buddha's very unashamed, unafraid acknowledgement of the suffering in life, because like many people, I'd come from a family with a tremendous amount of suffering. And like for many people, this was never, ever spoken about. And so I didn't know what to do with all of those feelings inside of me. And yet he was the Buddha saying right out loud, you're not alone. This isn't weird. This isn't a cause for isolation. There is suffering in life. And then he said, you can do something about that suffering. Not, of course, the suffering of loss or the things that actually happen, but the way we hold it, the way we do get isolated rather than connected with one another in a time of pain, the way we do get bitter rather than loving, all of those things. And he said, anybody can do something about the suffering of their own minds. And there are tools, they're very practical tools in meditation for that. So I heard that. And I thought, there was an independent study program at the university, and they designed it so that if you created a project that they liked and they approved of, you could go anywhere in the world, theoretically, for just 1 year and then come back and do your final year. So I created a project. I said, I want to go to India and study meditation. And they said, okay.
Wow.
So off I went.
Did you come back? I mean, did you come back after
that
year?
I took longer than a year. Yeah. It took longer than a year.
How long were you over there?
I was there at that point about 18 months.
Okay.
And then I came back. I ended up getting 2 years of independent study credit.
And what did you discover while you were over there?
Oh, I discovered everything. It was what I wanted was not philosophy or theory, and I didn't want to become a Buddhist or anything like that, but I wanted to know what those tools were and how to use them with some kind of confidence. And that was the other thing that was so beautiful. It wasn't that within the Buddhist framework, he was saying only special people can do this. Only lucky people can do this. Only
the anointed people can do this.
That's right. Only people from a certain background can do this. Anybody can do this if they put it into practice. And so I you know, I found the perfect kinds of situations which emphasize that. Really ways to learn the techniques, learn the methods, get confidence in them, and a lot of support in putting them into practice.
What's your favorite meditation?
I'd have to say loving kindness.
Can you say more about that for those of us who mm-hmm. don't know exactly what that means?
Yeah, it is a particular set of techniques, and it's found, of course, in many, many traditions. The way I learned it, the loving kindness practice, is a way of expanding our awareness so that we look at ourselves and we look at others differently. So in other words, if you're thinking about yourself, your day, at the end of the day, and you have the habit of only thinking about the mistakes you've made and the things you did wrong, we actually stretch our attention to include the good we've done or the good within us through wishing ourselves well. So we silently repeat certain phrases like, may I be happy, may I be peaceful, things like that, almost as a kind of blessing feeling. And then we look at all those many beings we may look right through or ignore who become the other, not because we don't like them, but because we don't even notice them. A checkout person in the supermarket or somebody who plays a role in our life that we don't tend to really stop and think, oh, this is a person who wants to be happy just like I do. So we do stop in that practice and we include them in our well-wishing as well. So we continue.
In the silent well-wishing?
Yeah,
or,
yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
As you're reflecting back on your day? Or like when you're actually when
you're doing the meditation.
Okay.
And then if you do it, I would say in the formal period of meditation, you will remember to do it when you're actually in line.
Yeah.
Otherwise, for most of us, that's a nice idea, but we haven't laid the groundwork to actually remember when we're flustered and it's snowing and.
Yeah.
And they're slow, you know, things like that. So we continually expand that field of awareness to include more and more people, creatures, until we come to all beings everywhere, all of life.
And I just want to emphasize that we have to start right here with me.
Isn't
we
that
have to start here. Mm-hmm. And I think that's hard for many of us to remember, and this is where we started our conversation, that, you know, once I can experience loving, just kindness toward myself, then I have some type of framework to actually be able to extend it out.
Yeah, I always found that fascinating. And people sometimes say to me, because I've written a lot of books on loving kindness meditation, people sometimes say to me, how'd you think of that? You know, or when did you make that up? And I said, well, I didn't make it up. This is, you know, this is right out of a very classical tradition.
So for thousands and thousands of years, people have been practicing.
Yeah. And just that way, start with yourself.
Uh-huh. Oh,
and then
good.
Move on.
Oh,
yeah.
Good. I love hearing that. Did you hear that? You're listening up. Sharon, how has your life changed since you have begun your journey on this path of loving kindness and vipassana and mindfulness?
Well, to my absolute amazement, it has been 40 years. So that's, you know, I met Ram Dass as an example at my very first meditation retreat in January of 1971.
Was that in this country? Or
no, it was in India.
In India, uh-huh.
And it was my junior year abroad.
Oh, great. Okay.
And, you know, so it's quite a hard question to answer because it's, you know, it's been most of my life. And so it really formed my life. It really gave me values. And the thing I appreciated, not only did it give me the reminder to always begin again and that we can, but it was the reminder that we don't just have to hold these values in an abstract sense. It's not just saying, wow. It's like people in New York City often say to me, wow, you know, it's all right for the Buddha, you know, fine for the Buddha sitting under a tree 2,500 years ago in India. It's too bad I live in Manhattan where it's so noisy. If only I didn't live in Manhattan. If only I didn't have so much going on. If only I wasn't so tired, then I could practice. But really, we can practice and we have to practice. We could sit around all day saying, you know, I think it would be good if people were kinder to one another. But how do we deal with our own fear and anger and sense of separation? And we have to do that work. And the meditation practices gave me, I think, some very practical tools for always coming back to, okay, let me breathe life into it. Let me make it real.
Are you happy?
I'm pretty happy.
Love that.
That's the problem with a book title like that, though. Are you really, really
right.
happy?
Yeah, tell us what that really means. Do you ever get unhappy?
Sure.
Yeah, good. I'm glad to hear that, too. Yeah. Do you ever get mad?
I do.
What do you do with anger? Boy, that just feels like, you know, a place where if we're enlightened, air quotes, we don't get angry or mad or...
Well, going back to that idea of every moment being a confluence of conditions coming together, I would say that if the conditions come together for anger to arise, it'll arise. That doesn't mean you have to lash out from it or hate yourself for it as the other extreme. It's almost more like a storm passing through you, and then you see what you want to do or say. So it's almost like making your awareness big enough so that it can accommodate that storm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then realizing you have a choice, because there's plenty of times we need to say or do something and not be passive or complacent. But usually when our motivation is anger, you know, it's lashing out, it's retaliation, it's something, it tends to be too narrow. Our field of action tends to be too narrow. It's like if you think of the last time you were really, really angry at yourself, it's not... generally a time when we have a more full picture of who we are, you know. Our whole sense of who we are and all that we will ever be collapses around whatever it is we're angry about. And so it's the same when we're angry at others. There's a kind of narrowing and tunnel vision that may not give us very good options.
There's a man that you refer to in your book who talks about this idea. I don't think I'm going to quote it. I know I'm not going to quote it exactly, but this idea of kind of becoming the observer of your own life and how it creates so much more spaciousness. And then you had talked about, right after you had written that, you had talked about being at an opera, mm-hmm. I think in Massachusetts,
yeah.
And there was this idea of the drama and the angst that's going on stage, and then there's this wide open sky above you. I love that imagery.
Yeah.
I think that's a great way to, I know for me, my vision has opened up. I'm confident in part due to meditating in that I have become an observer of my life, and I've found a number of things. One is there's very little that's actually really urgent. And boy, does that create a lot of spaciousness. I mean, it's amazing how much easier life becomes when you realize there's very few urgencies, if any. You know, I have this question mark. Maybe there's no urgencies, including death.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's hard for, I struggle because if I saw somebody I loved and they were having a problem, I'd probably want to rush in this with mm-hmm. a sense of urgency. And the idea of being kind to ourselves,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah, it was the opera in Santa Fe when
it was still
an open air theater in those days. And it was the first time I'd ever been to the opera. So mm-hmm. it was the perfect backdrop, that kind of immense, open, unconstrained, unconfined sky that Santa Fe is so famous for. And then all these people behaving rather operatically on the stage. So it was an amazing contrast. Yeah. And I think that's, however one expresses it, it is just that. It's about spaciousness that's not cold.
Yeah,
you know,
I like
it's not
that.
Distant or icy, but it is really immense.
Yeah.
And it's the capacity we have of awareness. That's actually its characteristic.
You know, one of the things that a phrase that I would use in my mind, and I think I just made this up, when I was first kind of entering into the whole mindfulness game. It is a game, actually. I feel like it's a game. Noticing myself. Oh, look, there's a person who, dot, 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 fill in the blank, whatever it is. Oh, look, there's a person who's really upset because this happened, or who's really sad because that happened, and it really takes it outside of my drama.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I can see how any person in that position could feel that way.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, it's actually interesting. One of my, friends and colleagues, Joseph Goldstein, had this sort of game he made up for his own meditation. If you're sitting in meditation with a group of people, pretend for a moment that the thought or the feeling that's disturbing you so much is arising in the mind of the person sitting next to you. And it's quite interesting just to see the transition, whereas there'd been so much judgment and dislike and angst about it, and then you imagine it arising in someone else, and you think, poor person, you know, that must hurt.
Yeah. We have a lot more compassion when we're looking at it beside us sometimes than within us. So tell us about the challenge.
The challenge. So the book was written so that it's almost like a curriculum in a way that you can, whether you're brand new to meditation or you have some experience, you can undertake it week one, week two, week three, week four. And because February has 28 days, some friends have organized what they're calling the Meditation Challenge, which a group of people is doing, and anyone is welcome to join, where they're really using the book as a kind of practice guide for that month. And then on my website, which is SharonSalzberg.com, there'll be a separate page where several people are blogging, and I'll be writing in response, and people are talking about their experience, and anyone is welcome to comment about their meditation experience, and it'll at some point be, you know, there'll be a lot of postings, and I'm going to do, being very modern, I'm going to do a tweet chat. I'm going to do four, I think, tweet chats.
Is this new for you, tweet chats?
Yes, I've done one. But I know the word.
Yeah,
I know the phrase.
I'm
very impressed, too, with myself. I don't know how to use my iPhone, but now I know what a tweet chat is, which for those of you who are on Twitter, you know, you can ask a question and I will respond in 140 characters or less. So I think it's a great thing. I hear a lot of self-organized groups are coming together and around bookstores and things like that, where people say, oh, we'll do it. You know, we'll do it as a group. And then we'll add comments to the site and we'll be able to read everything that people are going through. And for the people who are blogging, we really encourage them to be quite truthful. So it's not the impression that, oh, I've got a problem because my back hurts, whereas everyone else is sitting bathed in brilliant white light. What's wrong with me? But it'll be very honest.
Good. And so this show is sometime after you've started the challenge. So for somebody who's just going to go out and buy the book today or within the next few days, should they start on still on week one?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think, and you know, that'll be fine.
Great.
It'll be perfect.
Okay. So it's Sharon Salzberg, SalzbergSalzberg.com.
Right. Yeah.
And I will put a link on my website, JenniferTill.com, so people know where to find you. Sharon, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
You.
It's really been lovely.
It was wonderful.
Yeah. And thank you for tuning in this morning. And, I know that you're going to have a busy week coming up. So I want to remind you to be kind to yourself. And you can log on to my website to chat with other women who are looking at the same things that we are together. And until next Saturday morning at 8 o'clock, remember to ask yourself, what's the kindest thing that I can do for me right now? See you next week.